I just want us to, at the start, just with your neighbor where you are, from the point Gladys had us in Luke 22 last night at the Last Supper and spoke profoundly about God's love, from John 3. But from the point where Jesus had the Last Supper, think of how his day went from there through the night to the next day. Have a chat with your neighbor. What sort of things were happening? So, if I had longer, we would go around and get you all to share, but I just want you engaged in this process of thinking through the day that Jesus had. He had the Last Supper where he reshaped the Passover. And isn't it fascinating that, just in passing, that Jesus chose, he could have won our redemption on the Day of Atonement. He could have done, which would have been about the forgiveness of sin primarily, but he didn't. Which festival did he pick? The Passover. And what's the Passover about? Freedom from slavery. And sin forms part of that slavery, but it was an even bigger concept than just dealing with our guilt. It was to do with our imprisonment and our captivity to the Prince of Darkness. And Jesus reshapes the Passover with the bread and the wine, as we shared fittingly last night, but the lamb wasn't needed because the lamb was serving. And then Jesus arrives at Gethsemane, asks his friends to tarry with him an hour, as it says in the Old King James. And could they? No. So alone, Jesus shoulders up the sin and brokenness of the world. And it says then the angels ministered to him because, friends, that burden was heavier than the cross that he bore the next day. And indeed, would probably have killed him anyhow. And then he's betrayed by a kiss. And then he stood in front of the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, who organized themselves up as a kangaroo court because they're desperate to deal with Jesus. And God incarnate stands before his people and they condemn him. People who had prayed for the coming of the Messiah condemned Jesus. And then taken off, Peter denies outside as Caiaphas demands to know, are you the Messiah? And in Matthew's account, Jesus says, you have said it. You've said it. The high priest of the Jewish faith proclaims over Jesus his sonship. Jesus says, you've said it. He says, are you the Messiah? Jesus says, you're the one who's saying it. And instead of falling on his face in worship, he accuses Jesus of blasphemy. And at that point, the high priest tears his robes and they start crying out for Jesus to be put to death. They spit on him and beat him and jeer at him, even though he was everything that they accused him of wrongfully saying he was. That was his day. That was his day. And friends, we face some tough days in our life, but we've never faced that. We face our betrayals and people turning their back on us and people calling us what for. But Jesus is taking this as a sin bearer. He's carrying the brokenness of a wounded creation where we have taken our free will and run off in rebellion. And he stands judged by the court of the Jews. And then he's taken, bruised and sullied and despised, to Pilate. This is one of the coins that's been unearthed that they used at the temple as Jesus had overturned the money changers and got them for fleecing the poor who were buying their sacrifice. And then Jesus, taken from the Jewish councils, taken to Pilate. If you can see it, would you read with me? Now, Jesus was standing before Pilate, the Roman governor. "Are you the king of the Jews?" the governor asked him. Jesus replied, "You have said it." But when the leading priests and the elders made their accusations against him, Jesus remained silent. "Don't you hear all these charges they're bringing against you?" Pilate demanded. But Jesus made no response to any of the charges, much to the governor's surprise. Now it was the governor's custom each year during the Passover celebration to release one prisoner to the crowd, anyone they wanted. This year there was a notorious prisoner, a man named Barabbas. As the crowds gathered before Pilate's house that morning, he asked them, "Which do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah?" He knew very well that the religious leaders had arrested Jesus out of envy. Just then, as Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him this message, "Leave that innocent man alone. I suffered through a terrible nightmare about him last night." Meanwhile, the leading priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas to be released and for Jesus to be put to death. So the governor asked again, "Which of these two do you want me to release to you?" And the crowd shouted back, "Barabbas." And Pilate responded, "Then what should I do with Jesus who is called the Messiah?" And they shouted back, "Crucify him." "Why?" Pilate demanded. "What crime has he committed?" But the mob roared even louder, "Crucify him." Pilate saw that he wasn't going to get anywhere and that a riot was developing, so he sent for a bowl of water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. The responsibility is yours." And all the people yelled back, "We will take responsibility for his death, we and our children." Oh my goodness me. In the history of humanity, there has never been a greater miscarriage of justice. Jesus is accused, named the King of the Jews, the one who's called the Messiah. Pilate says, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And he says to Pilate, having been silent in the face of the accusation of the Jewish elders, he says again, "You have said it." And Pilate stands in judgment over Jesus. Not the kind of judgment that is fair, where the right thing is done, but the expedient political judgment of a cruel governor. And don't ever think that Pilate was anything other than cruel. He was brutal. Indeed, he was eventually deposed as governor of Judea when he suppressed a Samaritan revolt so brutally that even the authorities back in Rome thought he'd overstepped the mark. But he knows of the political machinations, and he's not releasing a prisoner because he's merciful. He's releasing a prisoner because at that time Jerusalem swelled from its 60,000 or so inhabitants to 250,000 Jews. They increased the garrison to look after all of the Passover pilgrims who came to Jerusalem, as good Jews would do at least once a year. And he knew the envy of the Jewish leaders. He'd heard of this Jesus. He decided he was going to play to that. For what did it matter if another religious nut job was put to death? It was no skin off his nose. And then the warning comes from his wife. It says, "Don't have anything to do with this innocent man." But Pilate's not listening. Many husbands find themselves in that position. And the crowd are asked, "Do you want Jesus or Barabbas?" I mean, it's not just that they've condemned him. It's not just expedient to get rid of him. But they choose a murderer over Jesus. People who witnessed Jesus healing sick people. People who witnessed his teaching. People, perhaps, who were cheering when he was coming in during the triumphal entry, decided to bay for blood because their political party or the family or whatever it was decided that was the right thing to do. And Barabbas, the guilty one, is released, symbolic of us. All of us stand in Barabbas' shoes, and Jesus shoulders up for us. So Pilate hands over Jesus to be flogged. And I won't go into the mechanics of that, but it's not just a whip. Matthew's quite explicit about that. It's a Roman scourge, a serious enough punishment that it could kill. And they beat him. And they ask him to prophesy. And they put a crown of thorns on his head. And they put a purple robe on his shoulders. And as this is all happening to Jesus, I wonder where he went in his own mind. Where did he go? Where did he retreat to while his body was being broken? This Lent, we've been working through the Sermon on the Mount. And perhaps Jesus went back, perhaps his disciples went back to some teaching that he had given. We've been looking at how the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' expression of how to live the life that he was living. You do not have to live life this way, but if you do, you will be able to access the power of the kingdom of the heavens, the love and compassion of God, just as Jesus did. To live in the reality of his love and the extraordinary power of his grace. And the Sermon on the Mount is the great central piece of teaching that Jesus has. And I wonder if at some point during this ordeal, Jesus went back to these words that he said. Do not judge others and you'll not be judged. For you will be treated as you treat others. The standard you use in judging is the standard by which you will be judged. And why worry about the speck in your friend's eye when you have a log in your own? How can you think of saying to your friend, let me help you get rid of that speck in your eye when you can't see the log in your own eye? Hypocrite. First get rid of the log in your own eye, then you will see well enough to deal with the speck in your friend's eye. Don't waste what is holy on people who are unholy. Don't throw your pearls to pigs. They will trample the pearls and then turn and attack you. There was no one more innocent than Jesus. The guilt that he shouldered up, he did so voluntarily. And he was a pearl before pigs. And he was crushed and trampled and judged. Judged by the Jews. Judged, of course, by Judas, who in all likelihood was another hot-headed insurrectionist looking for the flashpoint where Jesus would take on the Romans. Bitterly disappointed he was as to how his plans went that night. And indeed, according to Matthew's account of he was already dead by his own hand. And then Jesus stands before Pilate. Then Jesus stands before Pilate. Jesus has said, don't judge others. By the measure that you judge others, you'll be judged. Jesus stands before Pilate. And when Jesus says, don't judge, really what he's saying is don't condemn. We still have to use our judgment. That word in English doesn't help us. I remember wondering if being a judge was a legitimate Christian activity, seeing as Jesus said, don't judge, and judges are called judge. It was a foolish and short-sighted insight. But you know, I was young and enthusiastic. We need judges. Indeed, discerning things rightly is a good thing. And one of the extraordinary things about the Judeo-Christian tradition that goes through our whole, it's really the English common law, I'm sorry, if there's any SNP voters here, but we have inherited the English common law. There's a Scottish version of it too, but it kind of worked its way up through, and it assumes that even if someone has done something dreadful, there are limits to what you can do to them. That is an extraordinary gift to humanity, and it's one that stands square on the shoulders of Jesus of Nazareth. Nobody else had that idea. But Jesus stands before Pilate. And you got to wonder what was going through Jesus' mind. Pilate imagined that he was just looking at some other pie-in-the-sky Jewish visionary. There were others. You can read about them, but you probably never heard of them. You'll have never heard of Bar Kokhba or any of the other people who were put to death by the Romans because they had a similar vision to Jesus. Well, I say similar, but really it wasn't the same. And some of these were good people. But Pilate could do away with them without so much as a thought. And Jesus stands before Pilate. Pilate lets the Jewish elders accuse, and Jesus says nothing. Absolutely nothing in his defense. And as he's judged, he just takes it. Reflecting back what Isaiah had prophesied 600 years previous, where he'd said that he'll stand like a lamb before the slaughter. And there's no answer to the accusations that are coming from their mouth. And that he bore our sins. And by his stripes we're healed. The thing is by 36 AD, as I've said to you, Pilate's time in Judea, just 10 years rolled up. There is some notion that he actually committed suicide in the 40s. I don't know, but this I do know, he's dead. And that means that that meeting with Jesus that day was not the last time he met Jesus. You wonder how that conversation went. What do you think it was like when Pilate, at the end of his cruel, tortured political life, with blood on his hands, regardless of the washing bowl, and he finds himself stood in front of the risen Jesus Christ? What do you think went through his mind? He stood in judgment over Jesus, not knowing that the one that he was condemning would one day stand in judgment over him. Many of us struggle with people who have been wicked to us. Some of you have been through painful childhoods. Some of you have been through divorces. Some of you have been used and abused by people who should have known better, and you carry those wounds. And sometimes you wonder why it is they get away with it, along with the psalmist who often cries out, why is it that the wicked prosper and the righteous are under pressure? Let me tell you this, not one living soul who has ever sucked breath on planet Earth will not meet Jesus. Every last one of them will stand before him. And my goodness me, I am glad that someone saw fit to introduce me to him ahead of that meeting. And how do you think that might have gone? Perhaps Pilate will face him in shock and say, I never knew. Maybe Jesus says, depart from me. I don't know you. Maybe. Or maybe the mercy that changed the world and is deeper the foundations of this universe got through to him somehow. For he'd stood in the presence of Jesus, and even a rotten, filthy, murderous politician, even for that, Jesus has grace. If there was any shred of penitence in that man. Why am I telling you that story? Well, because this week, this month, this year, you will see people do things that are wrong. And some of them are going to hurt you. And when that happens, I want you to remember what Jesus did when he shouldered up our sin and our sorrow. Did he retaliate? Did he bring a bolt of lightning? Sometimes people say, Mark, I can't come to church because the roof will fall in. This is the stupidest thing to say, because everybody who's in a church has got to know Jesus for themselves, and the roof is still okay. We did lose a bit of it when the steeple came in, but that was due to builders cutting corners in the 1800s, not divine retribution. When we face people who we know have done wrong, we've got to tread very carefully. For our task is to discern, and we may discern that our mother or father, that our brother or sister, that our son or daughter, that our friend, our neighbor, our enemy has done something wrong. But what we do next is not easy to discern. We might figure out that it's wrong, but then we have to remember there may be a log in our eye as well as the speck in theirs, that we have been forgiven much, so we need to forgive much. We need to remember how Jesus dealt with Pilate. We need to remember that mercy triumphs over judgment according to Jesus' kid brother. And if Jesus' kid brother can get that, that's James, by the way, then so must we. And just because we have been wronged does not give us permission to craft our vengeance. Vengeance belongs to God because that's where it properly belongs. Now, does that mean we bypass the anger? No. No, indeed, we need to go through the anger more honestly, because if we don't deal with it, then we'll be left with resentment. But when we face people, we need to do very careful work with our Father in heaven to be able to deal with this. It sometimes takes hours, sometimes weeks, sometimes years. But Jesus says this. When he says, do not judge others, he says, discern, do not condemn. It's not your job. You don't want it. No matter how much you want the person who has hurt you to hurt along with you. That's kind of serious, isn't it? I'm not going to leave on that note. Because how wonderful is Jesus? How wonderful is he? There's not a crooked bone in his body, not an unworthy thought in his mind. There's not an unwise word that ever came from his lips, not an unloving action that he ever committed. You have the great privilege of sharing your life with the most trustworthy, loving, extraordinary person who ever walked the face of the earth and whose character reveals the Father heart of God to us. Always with you, always there, always, always. And for every dark day that you have ever faced and every dark day that you ever will face, he is with you. And he will never leave you or forsake you. And whenever somebody wounds you, they got to him first. For everything that Jesus shouldered up is everything that's happened to you, is happening to you, and will happen to you. And the right response is a gracious and thankful gratitude that he has already shouldered up our pain, our rage, and our sorrow. And as the psalmist says, he has gathered up our tears and put them in a jar. Because Jesus didn't conquer death to make a point. He conquered death to start the recreation of the world, of the universe. And our place is in a new heaven and earth where we have been invited. The opening ceremony is the marriage feast of the Lamb. He has your name written on a note, and you're going to be delighted by who you sit beside, though you might be surprised. And from then on in, further in and further up for the rest of eternity, we will be together with him. That's what he is doing. Last thought. The world doesn't need the church to wag its finger and say that's wrong, or you're wrong, or that way of relating's out, or we don't want that, and we don't want this, and we don't want that, and we don't want this. Our job is to embody Jesus to a world that's lost. And as I was hearing this week from the wonderful saint who's home now, Dallas Willard, lost is not a function of where we're going. It's not that we're destined for hell. It's we don't know where we are. We don't know where we are. And that's hell enough. You're here on planet Earth and don't understand why. That's what lost really means. And if it means up, you wind up in hell, that's a great sorrow. Our task is to carry on to seek and save the lost. And this Easter, just someone, you're going to come across someone. It's going to happen to somebody, otherwise they wouldn't have been given this word. You're going to have a choice between condemning someone, or you're going to have the choice between inviting them into the life in all its fullness that is life with Jesus Christ. Please choose the latter and put your condemnation away. Discern all you like. Understand why it's wrong. But then put it in your back pocket and make sure you share the love of Jesus with someone who doesn't know him while you're still sucking breath. Amen? For he did it for us. But not just us. If we were a church of 600, there'd still be 90% of this village who don't know him yet or are not walking with him week by week. We got work to do, folks. Shall we worship? Let's pray.